this room, and there was no way he could impersonate a skeleton. Under one of the two bunk stacks at the rear, risky, but it would serve, unless... Jake spied another door. He sprang forward, depressed the lever handle, and pulled the door open. It was a closet. And closets made fine hiding places, but this one was filled with jumbles of dusty electronic equipment, top to bottom. Some of it fell out. "Beans," he whispered in a low, urgent voice. He picked up what had fallen, tossed it high and low, then shut the closet door again. Okay, it would have to be under one of the beds. "Welcome to Arc Quadrant Outpost 16, boomed the recorded voice. Jake flinched and saw another door, this one to his left, and standing partway open. Try the door, or squeeze under one of the two tiers of bunks at the rear of the room. He had time to try one bolt hole or the other, but not both. "This is a medium security outpost." Jake went for the door, and it was just as well he went when he did, because Sleitman didn't let the recording finish its spiel. 99, came his voice from the loudspeakers, and the recording thanked him. It was another closet, this one empty except for two or three moldering shirts in one corner and a dust-caked poncho slumped on a hook. The air was almost as dusty as the poncho, and Oi uttered three fast, delicate sneezes as he padded in. Jake dropped to one knee and put an arm around Oi's slender neck. "No more of that, unless you want to get us both killed," he said. "You be quiet, Oi."
"Quiet, Oi,"
the bumbler whispered back and winked. Jake reached up and pulled the door back to within 2 inches of shut, as it had been before. He hoped. 11. He could hear them quite clearly, too clearly. Jake realized there were mics and speakers all over this place. The idea did nothing for his peace of mind, because if he and Oi could hear them... It was the cactuses they were talking about, or rather that Sleitman was talking about. He called them boom flurry, and wanted to know what had gotten them all fashed.
"Almost certainly more rock cats, I," Andy said in his complacent, slightly prissy voice.
Eddie said Andy reminded him of a robot named C-3PO in Star Wars, a movie to which Jake had been looking forward. He had missed it by less than a month.
"It's their mating season, you know."
"Piss on that," Sleitman said. "Are you telling me boom flurry don't know rock cats from something they can actually catch and eat? Someone's been out here, I tell you, and not long since." A cold thought slipped into Jake's mind. Had the floor of the Dogon been dusty? He'd been too busy gawking at the control panels and TV monitors to notice. If he and Oi had left tracks, those two might have noticed already. They might only be pretending to have a conversation about the cactuses while they actually crept toward the bunkroom door. Jake took the Ruger out of the docker's clutch and held it in his right hand with his thumb on the safety.
"A guilty conscience doth make cowards of us all," Andy said in his complacent, just-thought-you'd-like-to-know voice. "That's my free adaptation of a..."
"Shut up, you bag of bolts and wires," Sleitman snarled. "I..." Then he screamed. Jake felt Oi stiffen against him, felt his fur begin to rise. The bumbler started to growl. Jake slipped a hand around his snout.
"Let go," Sleitman cried out. "Let go of me."
"Of course, Cy Sleitman," Andy said, now sounding solicitous. "I only pressed a small nerve in your elbow, you know. There would be no lasting damage unless I applied at least 20 foot-pounds of pressure."
"Why in the hell would you do that?"
Sleitman sounded injured, almost whiny.
"Ain't I doing all you could want and more? Ain't I risking my life for my boy?
Not to mention a few little extras," Andy said silkily. "Your spectacles. The music machine you keep deep down in your saddlebag. And, of course..."
"You know why I'm doing it and what'd happen to me if I was found out," Sleitman said.
The whine had gone out of his voice. Now he sounded dignified and a little weary. Jake listened to that tone with growing dismay. If he got out of this and had to squeal on Benny's da, he wanted to squeal on a villain.
"Yar, I've taken a few little extras. You say true, I say thank you. Glasses so I can see better to betray the people I've known all my life. A music machine so I won't have to hear the conscience you prate about so easy and can get to sleep at night.
Then you pinch something in my arm that makes me feel like my byriza eyes are going to fall right out of my byriza head.
I allow it from the rest of them, Andy said, and now his voice had changed.
Jake once more thought of Blaine, and once more his dismay grew. What if Tian Jaffords heard this voice? What if Von Eisenhardt heard it, Overholzer, the rest of the Falcon?
They heap contumely on my head like hot coals, and never do I raise a word of protest, let alone a hand. Go here, Andy. Go there, Andy. Stop your foolish singing, Andy. Stuff your prattle. Don't tell us of the future, because we don't want to hear it. So I don't, except of the wolves, because they'd hear what makes them sad, and I'd tell them, yes, I would. To me, each tear's a drop of gold. You're not but a stupid pile of lights and wires, they say. Tell us the weather, sing the babby to sleep, then get the hell out of here, and I allow it. Foolish Andy am I, every child's toy and always fair game for a tongue-whipping. But I won't take a tongue-whipping from you, Sai. You hope to have a future in the Kala after the wolves are done with it for another few years, don't you?
You know I do, Sleitman said, so low Jake could barely hear him. And I deserve it.
You and your son both say thank you, passing your days in the Kala, both say Kamala. And that can happen, but it depends on more than the death of the Outworlders. It depends on my silence. If you want it, I demand respect.
That's absurd, Sleitman said after a brief pause. From his place in the closet, Jake agreed wholeheartedly. A robot demanding respect was absurd. But so was a giant bear patrolling an empty forest, a Morlock thug trying to unravel the secrets of dipolar computers, or a train that lived only to hear and solve new riddles.
And besides, hear me, I beg, how can I respect you when I don't even respect myself?
There was a mechanical click in response to this, very loud. Jake had heard Blaine make a similar sound when he, or it, had felt the absurd closing in, threatening to fry his logic circuits. Then Andy said,
No answer, 19. Connect and report, Sai Sleitman. Let's have done with this.
All right. There were 30 or 40 seconds worth of keyboard clatter, then a high, warbling whistle that made Jake wince and Oi whine far back in his throat. Jake had never heard a sound quite like it. He was from the New York of 1977, and the word modem would have meant nothing to him. The shriek cut off abruptly. There was a moment's silence, then,
This is Algol Siento, Finley Otego here. Please give your password. You have 10 seconds.
Saturday, Sleitman replied, and Jake frowned. Had he ever heard that happy weekend word on this side? He didn't think so.
Thank you. Algol Siento acknowledges. We are online.
There was another brief, shrieking whistle, then,
Report, Saturday.
Sleitman told of watching Roland and the younger one going up to the Cave of the Voices, where there was now some sort of door, very likely conjured by the Manny. He said he'd used the Farseer and thus gotten a very good look.
Telescope, Andy said.
He had reverted to his slightly prissy, complacent voice.
Such are called telescopes.
Would you care to make my report, Andy? Sleitman inquired with cold sarcasm.
Cry pardon, Andy said in a long-suffering voice. Cry pardon, go on as you will.
There was a pause. Jake could imagine Sleitman glaring at the robot, the glare robbed of its ferocity by the way the foreman would have to crane his neck in order to deliver it. Finally, he went on. They left their horses below and walked up. They carried a pink sack, which they passed from hand to hand as if 'twere heavy. Whatever was in it had square edges. I could make that out through the telescope, Farseer. May I offer 2 guesses?
Yes.
First, they might have been putting 2 or 3 of the pair's most valuable books in safekeeping. If that's the case, a wolf should be sent to destroy them after the main mission's accomplished.
Why?
The voice was perfectly cold, not a human being's voice, Jake was sure of that. The sound of it made him feel weak and afraid. Why, as an example, do it please ya, Sleitman said, as if this should have been obvious. As an example to the priest.
Callahan will very soon be beyond examples, the voice said. What is your other guess?
When Sleitman spoke again, he sounded shaken. Jake hoped the traitor son of a bitch was shaken. He was protecting his son, sure, his only son. But why he thought that gave him the right? It may have been maps, Sleitman said. I've thought long and long that a man who has books is apt to have maps. He may have given him maps of the eastern regions leading into Thunderclap. They haven't been shy about saying that's where they plan to head next. If it is maps they took up there, much good may they do him, even if they live. Next year, north'll be east, and likely the year after, it'll swap places with south. In the dusty darkness of the closet, Jake could suddenly see Andy watching Sleitman make his report. Andy's blue electric eyes were flashing. Sleitman didn't know. No one in the Kala knew, but that rapid flashing was the way DNF-34821-V-63 expressed humor. He was, in fact, laughing at Sleitman. Because he knows better, Jake thought. Because he knows what's really in that bag, better box of cookies that he does. Could he be so sure of that? Was it possible to use the touch on a robot? If it can think, the gunslinger in his head spoke up, then you can touch it. Well, maybe. Whatever it was, it's a damn good indication they really do plan to take the kids into the Arroyos, Sleitman was saying. Not that they'd put him in that cave.
No, no, not that cave, Andy said, and although his voice was as prissy serious as ever, Jake could imagine his blue eyes flashing even faster. Almost stuttering, in fact. Too many voices in that cave. They'd scare the children, you're bugger.
DNF-34821-V-63, messenger robot. Messenger! You could accuse Sleitman of treachery, but how could anyone accuse Andy of it? What he did, what he was, had been stamped on his chest for the whole world to see. There it had been in front of all of them. Gods! Benny's Da, meanwhile, was plodding stolidly on with his report to Finley Otego, who was in some place called Al Gulciento. The mine he showed us on the map the Taveries drew is the Gloria, and the Gloria ain't but a mile off from the Cave of the Voices, but the bastard's trig. Can I give another guess?
Yes.
The arroyo that leads to the Gloria mine splits off to the south about a quarter mile in. There's another old mine at the end of the spur, the Redbird II, it's called. Their din is telling folks he means to put the kids in the Gloria, and I think he'll tell them the same at the meeting he's going to call later this week, the one where he asks leave to stand against the wolves. But I believe that when the time comes, he'll stick them in the Redbird instead. He'll have the Sisters of Oriza standing guard, in front and up above as well, and you'd do well not to underestimate those ladies.
How many?
I think 5, if he puts Sari Adams among him. Plus some men with bars. He'll have the brownie throwing with him, Kennet, and I hear she's good. Maybe best of all. But one way or the other, we know where the kids are going to be. Putting them in such a place is a mistake, but he don't know it. He's dangerous, but grown old in his thinking. Probably such a strategy has worked for him before. And it had, of course. In Eyebolt Canyon. Against Latigo's men. The important thing now is finding out where he and the boy and the younger man are going to be when the wolves come. He may tell at the meeting. If he don't, he may tell Eisenhart afterward.
Or Overholzer.
No, Eisenhart will stand with him. Overholzer won't.
You must find out where they'll be.
I know, Sleitman said. We'll find out, Andy and I, and then make one more trip to this unblessed place. After that, I swear by the Lady Oriza and the man Jesus, I've done my part. Now, can we get out of here?
In a moment, Si, Andy said. I have my own report to make, you know.
There was another of those long, whistling shrieks. Jake ground his teeth and waited for it to be over, and finally it was. Finley Otego signed off.
Are we done? Sleitman asked.
Unless you have some reason to linger, I believe we are. Andy said.
Does anything in here seem different to you? Sleitman asked suddenly, and Jake felt his blood turn cold.
No, Andy said, but I have great respect for human intuition. Are you having intuition, Sai?
There was a pause that seemed to go on for at least a full minute, although Jake knew it must have been much shorter than that. He held Oi's head against his thigh and waited.
No, Sleitman said at last. Guess I'm just getting jumpy, now that it's close. God, I wish it was over. I hate this.
You're doing the right thing, Sai.
Jake didn't know about Sleitman, but Andy's plumbly sympathetic tone made him feel like gnashing his teeth.
The only thing, really, tisn't your fault that your father to the only mateless twin in Calabrin Sturgis, is it? I know a song that makes this point in particularly moving fashion. Perhaps you'd like to hear...
Shut up, Sleitman cried in a choked voice. Shut up, you mechanical devil. I've sold my goddamn soul. Isn't that enough for you? Must I be made sport of as well?
If I've offended, I apologize from the bottom of my admittedly hypothetical heart, Andy said. In other words, I cry your pardon.
Sounding sincere, sounding as though he meant every word, sounding as though butter wouldn't melt. Yet Jake had no doubt that Andy's eyes were flashing out in gales of silent blue laughter. 12. The conspirators left. There was an odd, meaningless jingle of melody from the overhead speakers, meaningless to Jake at least, and then silence. He waited for them to discover his pony, come back, search for him, find him, kill him. When he had counted to 120 and they hadn't returned to the Dogon, he got to his feet. The overdose of adrenaline in his system left him feeling as stiff as an old man, and went back into the control room. He was just in time to see the motion sensor lights in front of the place switch off. He looked at the monitor showing the top of the rise and saw the Dogon's most recent visitors walking between the boom flurry. This time the cactuses didn't move. They had apparently learned their lesson. Jake watched Sleitman and Andy go, bitterly amused by the difference in their heights. Whenever his father saw such a Mutt and Jeff duo on the street, he inevitably said, "Put him in vaudeville." It was about as close to a joke as Elmer Chambers could get. When this particular duo was out of sight, Jake looked down at the floor. No dust, of course. No dust and no tracks. He should have seen that when he came in. Certainly Roland would have seen that. Roland would have seen everything. Jake wanted to leave, but made himself wait. If they saw the motion lights glare back on behind them, they'd probably assume it was a rock cat, or maybe what Benny called an armadillo. But probably wasn't good enough. To pass the time, he looked at the various control panels, many of which had the Lemerck Industries name on them. Yet he also saw the familiar GE and IBM logos, plus one he didn't know, Microsoft. All of these latter gadgets were stamped Made in USA. The Lemerck products bore no such mark. He was pretty sure some of the keyboards he saw, there were at least 24, controlled computers. What other gadgetry was there? How much was still up and running? Were there weapons stored here? He somehow thought the answer to this last question was no. If there had been weapons, they had no doubt been decommissioned or appropriated. Very likely by Andy, the messenger robot. Many other functions. At last, he decided it was safe to leave. If, that was, he was extremely careful, rode slowly back to the river and took pains to approach the rocking bee the back way. He was nearly to the door when another question occurred to him. Was there a record of his and Oi's visit to the Dogon? Were they on videotape somewhere? He looked at the operating TV screens, sparing his longest stare for the one showing the control room. He and Oi were on it again. From the camera's high angle, anyone in the room would have to be in that picture.
Let it go, Jake, the gunslinger in his head advised. There's nothing you can do about it, so just let it go. If you try poking and prying, you're apt to leave sign. You might even set off an alarm.
The idea of tripping an alarm convinced him. He picked up Oi, as much for comfort as anything else, and got the hell out. His pony was exactly where Jake had left him, cropping dreamily at the bushes in the moonlight.
There were no tracks in the hard pan, but, Jake saw, he wasn't leaving any himself. Andy would have broken through the crusty surface enough to leave tracks, but not him. He wasn't heavy enough. Probably Benny's Dow wasn't either. Quit it. If they'd smelled you, they would have come back. Jake supposed that was true, but he still felt more than a little like Goldilocks tiptoeing away from the House of the Three Bears. He led his pony back to the desert road, then put on the duster and slipped Oi into the wide front pocket. As he mounted up, he thumped the bumbler a fairly good one on the saddle horn.
"Ouch, ache," Oi said.
"Quit it, you baby," Jake said, turning his pony back in the direction of the river. "Gotta be quiet now."
"Quiet,"
Oi agreed, and gave him a wink.
Jake worked his fingers down through the bumbler's heavy fur and scratched the place Oi liked the best. Oi closed his eyes, stretched his neck to an almost comical length, and grinned. When they got back to the river, Jake dismounted and peered over a boulder in both directions. He saw nothing, but his heart was in his throat all the way across to the other side. He kept trying to think what he would say if Benny's Da hailed him and asked him what he was doing out here in the middle of the night. Nothing came. In English class, he'd almost always gotten A's on his creative writing assignments, but now he was discovering that fear and invention did not mix. If Benny's Da hailed him, Jake would be caught. It was as simple as that. There was no hail. Not crossing the river, not going back to the rocking bee, not unsaddling the horse and rubbing him down. The world was silent, and that was just fine with Jake. 13. Once Jake was back on his pallet and pulling the covers to his chin, Oi jumped up on Benny's bed and lay down, nose once more under his tail. Benny made a deep sleep muttering sound, reached out, and gave the bumbler's flank a single stroke. Jake lay looking at the sleeping boy, troubled. He liked Benny. His openness, his appetite for fun, his willingness to work hard when there were chores that needed doing. He liked Benny's yodeling laugh when something struck him funny, and the way they were evenly matched in so many things, and until tonight, Jake had liked Benny's Da, too. He tried to imagine how Benny would look at him when he found out that A, his father was a traitor, and B, his friend had squealed on him. Jake thought he could bear anger. It was hurt that would be hard. "You think hurt's all it'll be? Simple hurt? You better think again. There aren't many props under Benny Sleitman's world, and this is going to knock them all out from under him. Every single one. Not my fault that his father's a spy and a traitor." But it wasn't Benny's either. If you asked Sleitman, he'd probably say it wasn't even his fault, that he'd been forced into it. Jake guessed that was almost true, completely true if you looked at things with a father's eye. What was it that the Collas twins made and the wolves needed? Something in their brains, very likely. Some sort of enzyme or secretion not produced by singleton children. Maybe the enzyme or secretion that created the supposed phenomenon of twin telepathy. Whatever it was, they could take it from Benny Sleitman, because Benny Sleitman only looked like a singleton. Had his sister died, well, that was tough titty, wasn't it? Very tough titty, especially for the father who loved the only one left, who couldn't bear to let him go.
Suppose Roland kills him. How will Benny look at you then?
Once, in another life, Roland had promised to take care of Jake Chambers, and then let him drop into the darkness. Jake had thought there could be no worse betrayal than that. Now he wasn't so sure. No, not so sure at all. These unhappy thoughts kept him awake for a long time. Finally, half an hour or so before the first hint of dawn touched the horizon, he fell into a thin and troubled sleep. Chapter 4. The Pied Piper. 1. "We are Ka-Tet," said the gunslinger. "We are one from many." He saw Callahan's doubtful look. It was impossible to miss, and nodded. "Yes, Pear, you're one of us. I don't know for how long, but I know it's so. And so do my friends." Jake nodded. So did Eddie and Susanna. They were in the pavilion today.
After hearing Jake's story, Roland no longer wanted to meet at the rectory house, not even in the backyard. He thought it all too likely that Sleitman or Andy, maybe even some other as yet unsuspected friend of the wolves, had placed listening devices as well as cameras there. Overhead, the sky was gray, threatening rain, but the weather remained remarkably warm for so late in the season. Some civic-minded ladies or gents had raked away the fallen leaves in a wide circle around the stage where Roland and his friends had introduced themselves not so long ago, and the grass beneath was as green as summer. There were falcon flying kites, couples promenading hand in hand, two or three outdoor tradesmen keeping one eye out for customers and the other on the low-bellied clouds overhead. On the bandstand, the group of musicians who had played them into Calla Bryn Sturgis with such brio were practicing a few new tunes. On two or three occasions, townsfolk had started toward Roland and his friends, wanting to pass a little time, and each time it happened, Roland shook his head in an unsmiling way that turned them around in a hurry. The time for "so good to meet you" politics had passed. They were almost down to what Susanna called the real nitty-gritty. Roland said, "In 4 days comes the meeting. This time I think of the entire town, not just the men."
"Damn well told it ought to be the whole town," Susanna said. "If you're counting on the ladies to throw the dish and make up for all the guns we don't have, I don't think it's too much to let them into the damn hall."
"Won't be in the gathering hall if it's everyone," Callahan said. "There won't be room enough. We'll light the torches and have it right out here."
"And if it rains?" Eddie asked.
"If it rains, people will get wet," Callahan said, and shrugged.
4 days to the meeting, and 9 to the wolves," Roland said. "This will very likely be our last chance to palaver as we are now, sitting down with our heads clear, until this is over. We won't be here long, so let's make it count." He held out his hands. Jake took one, Susanna the other. In a moment, all five were joined in a little circle, hand to hand. "Do we see each other?"
"See you very well," Jake said.
"Very well, Roland," said Eddie.
"Clear as day, Shug,"
Susanna agreed, smiling. Oi, who was sniffing in the grass nearby, said nothing, but he did look around and tip a wink.
"Pear?" Roland asked.
"I see and hear you very well," Callahan agreed with a small smile. "And I'm glad to be included. So far, at least."
Two. Roland, Eddie, and Susanna had heard most of Jake's tale. Jake and Susanna had heard most of Roland's and Eddie's. Now Callahan got both, what he later called the double feature. He listened with his eyes wide and his mouth frequently agape. He crossed himself when Jake told of hiding in the closet. To Eddie, the pair said,
"You didn't mean it about killing the wives and children, of course. That was just a bluff."
Eddie looked up at the heavy sky, considering this with a faint smile. Then he looked back at Callahan.
"Roland tells me that for a guy who doesn't want to be called father, you've taken some very fatherly stands just lately. If you're speaking about the idea of terminating your wife's pregnancy," Eddie raised a hand, "let's say I'm not speaking of any one thing in particular. It's just that we've got a job to do here, and we need you to help us do it. The last thing we need is to get sidetracked by a lot of your old Catholic blather, so let's just say yes, I was bluffing and move on. Will that serve, Father?"
Eddie's smile had grown strained and exasperated. There were bright smudges of color on his cheekbones. Callahan considered the look of him with great care and then nodded.
"Yes," he said, "you were bluffing. By all means, let's leave it at that and move on."
"Good,"
Eddie said. He looked at Roland. "The first question is for Susanna," Roland said. "It's a simple one. How are you feeling?"
"Just fine," she replied.
"Say true?" She nodded.
"Say true, say thank you."
"No headaches here?" Roland rubbed above his left temple.
"No."
and the jittery feelings I used to get just after sunset, just before dawn, have quit. And look at me. She ran a hand down the swell of her breasts, to her waist, to her right hip. I've lost some of the fullness. Roland, I've read that sometimes animals in the wild, carnivores like wild cats, herbivores like deer and rabbits, reabsorb their babies if the conditions to have them are adverse. You don't suppose? She trailed off, looking at him hopefully. Roland wished he could have supported this charming idea, but he couldn't. And withholding the truth within the quartet was no longer an option. He shook his head. Susanna's face fell. "She's been sleeping quietly, so far as I can tell," Eddie said. "No sign of Mia." "Rosalita says the same," Callahan added. "You got that, Jane, watching me," Susanna said in a suspiciously Detta-like tone, but she was smiling. "Every now and then," Callahan admitted.
"Let's leave the subject of Susanna's chap, if we may," Roland said. "We need to speak of the wolves. Them, and little else."
"But Roland," Eddie began.
Roland held up his hand. "I know how many other matters there are. I know how pressing they are. I also know that if we become distracted, we're apt to die here in Calabrin Sturgis. And dead gunslingers can help no one. Nor do they go their course. Do you agree?" His eyes swept them. No one replied. Somewhere in the distance was the sound of many children singing. The sound was high and gleeful and innocent. Something about Kamala. "There is one other bit of business that we must address," Roland said. "It involves you, Pear, and what's now called the Doorway Cave. Will you go through that door and back to your country?"
"Are you kidding?" Callahan's eyes were bright. "A chance to go back, even for a little while? You just say the word."
Roland nodded. "Later today, mayhap you and I will take a little passeer on up there. And I'll see you through the door. You know where the vacant lot is, don't you?"
"Sure. I must have been past it 1,000 times back in my other life. And you understand about the zip code?" Eddie asked. "If Mr. Tower did as you requested, it'll be written at the end of the board fence, 46th Street side. That was brilliant, by the way."
"Get the number. And get the date, too," Roland said. "We have to keep track of the time over there if we can. Eddie's right about that. Get it and come back. Then, after the meeting in the pavilion, we'll need you to go through the door again."
"This time to wherever Tower and Deepnow are in New England," Callahan guessed.
"Yes," Roland said.
"If you find them, you'll want to talk mostly to Mr. Deepnow," Jake said.
He flushed when they all turned to him, but kept his eyes trained on Callahan's.
"Mr. Tower might be stubborn." "That's the understatement of the century," Eddie said. "By the time you get there, he'll probably have found 12 used bookstores and God knows how many first editions of Indiana Jones's 19th Nervous Breakdown."
"But Mr. Deepnow will listen," Jake went on.
"It's an ache,"
Oi said, and rolled over onto his back.
"It's an quiet."
Scratching Oi's belly, Jake said, "If anyone can convince Mr. Tower to do something, it'll be Mr. Deepnow."
"Okay," Callahan replied, nodding. "I hear you well."
The singing children were closer now. Susanna turned, but couldn't see them yet. She assumed they were coming up River Street. If so, they'd be in view once they cleared the livery and turned down the high street at Took's General Store. Some of the folk on the porch over there were already getting up to look. Roland, meanwhile, was studying Eddie with a small smile. "Once, when I used the word assume, you told me a saying about it from your world. I'd hear it again if you remember." Eddie grinned.
"Assume makes an ass out of you and me. Is that the one you mean?"
Roland nodded. "It's a good saying. All the same, I'm going to make an assumption now, pound it like a nail, and hang all our hopes of coming out of this alive on it. I don't like it, but see no choice. The assumption is that only Ben Sleitman and Andy are working against us. That if we take care of them when the time comes, we can move in secrecy."
"Don't kill him,"
Jake said, in a voice almost too low to hear.
He had drawn Oi close and was petting the top of his head and his long neck with a kind of compulsive, darting speed. Oi bore this patiently.
"Cry pardon, Jake," Susanna said, leaning forward and tipping a hand behind one ear. "I didn't..." "Don't kill him."
This time his voice was hoarse and wavering and close to tears.
"Don't kill Benny's dad, please."
Eddie reached out and cupped the nape of the boy's neck gently.
"Jake, Benny Sleitman's da is willing to send 100 kids off into Thunderclap with the wolves just to spare his own. And you know how they'd come back."
"Yeah, but in his eyes, he doesn't have any choice because..."
"His choice could have been to stand with us," Roland said. His voice was dull and dreadful, almost dead.
But what? Jake didn't know. He had been over this, and he still didn't know. Sudden tears spilled from his eyes and ran down his cheeks. Callahan reached out to touch him. Jake pushed his hand away. Roland sighed.
"We'll do what we can to spare him. That much I promise you. I don't know if it'll be a mercy or not. The Sleitmans are going to be through in this town, if there's a town left after the end of next week. But perhaps they'll go north or south along the Crescent and start some sort of new life. And Jake, listen, there's no need for Ben Sleitman to ever know you overheard Andy and his father last night."
Jake was looking at him with an expression that didn't quite dare to be hope. He didn't care a hill of beans about Sleitman the Elder, but he didn't want Benny to know it was him. He supposed that made him a coward, but he didn't want Benny to know.
"Really? For sure?"
"Nothing about this is for sure, but..." Before he could finish, the singing children swept around the corner, leading them, silver limbs and golden body gleaming mellowly in the day's subdued light. Was Andy the messenger robot? He was walking backward. In one hand was a bob bolt wrapped in banners of bright silk. To Susanna, he looked like a parade marshal on the 4th of July. He waved his baton extravagantly from side to side, leading the children in their song while a reedy bagpipe accompaniment issued from the speakers in his chest and head.
"Holy shit," Eddie said. "It's the Pied Piper of Hamelin."
3.
"Kamala, come one, mama had a son, dasa time a daddy had the most fun."
Andy sang this part alone, then pointed his baton at the crowd of children. They joined in boisterously.
"Kamala, come, come, daddy had one, dasa time at mommy had the most fun."
Gleeful laughter. There weren't as many kids as Susanna would have thought, given the amount of noise they were putting out. Seeing Andy there at their head after hearing Jake's story chilled her heart. At the same time, she felt an angry pulse begin to beat in her throat and her left temple. That he should lead them down the street like this, like the Pied Piper. Eddie was right, like the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Now he pointed his makeshift baton at a pretty girl who looked 13 or 14. Susanna thought she was one of the Anselm kids from the small hole just south of T. and Jaffords' place. She sang out the next verse bright and clear to that same heavily rhythmic beat, which was almost, but not quite, a skip-rope chant.
"Kamala, come too. You know what to do. Plant the rice, Kamala. Don't you be no fool."
Then, as the others joined in again, Susanna realized that the group of children was bigger than she'd thought when they came around the corner, quite a bit bigger. Her ears had told her truer than her eyes, and there was a perfectly good reason for that.
"Kamala, come too," they sang. "Daddy no foo. Mommy plant Kamala 'cause she know just what to do."
The group looked smaller at first glance because so many of the faces were the same. The face of the Anselm girl, for instance, was nearly the face of the boy next to her, her twin brother. Almost all the kids in Andy's group were twins. Susanna suddenly realized how eerie this was, like all the strange doublings they'd encountered caught in a bottle. Her stomach turned over, and she felt the first twinge of pain above her left eye. Her hand began to rise toward the tender spot.
"No," she told herself, "I don't feel that."
She made the hand go back down. There was no need to rub her brow, no need to rub what didn't hurt. Andy pointed his baton at a strutting, pudgy little boy who couldn't have been more than 8. He sang the words out in a high and childish treble that made the other kids laugh.
Kamala, come tree. You know what to be. Plant the rice, Kamala, and the rice will make you free.
To which the chorus replied, Kamala, come tree. Rice will make you free. When you plant the rice, Kamala, you know just what to be. Andy saw Roland's quartet and waved his baton cheerily. So did the children, half of whom would come back drooling and ruined if the parade marshal had his way. They would grow to the size of giants, screaming with pain, and then die early. Wave back, Roland said, and raised his hand. Wave back, all of you, for the sake of your fathers. Eddie flashed Andy a happy, toothy grin.
How you doing, you cheap shit Radio Shack dickweed?
He asked. The voice coming through his grin was low and savage. He gave Andy a double thumbs up.
How you doing, you robot psycho? Say fine. Say thank you. Say bite my bag.
Jake burst out laughing at that. They all continued waving and smiling. The children waved and smiled back. Andy also waved. He led his merry band down the high street, chanting Kamala come four, Rivers at the door.
They love him, Callahan said.
There was a strange, sick expression of disgust on his face.
Generations of children have loved Andy.
That, Roland remarked, is about to change. 4. Further questions? Roland asked when Andy and the children were gone. Ask now, if you will. It could be your last chance.
What about Tian Jaffords? Callahan asked. In a very real sense, it was Tian who started this. There ought to be a place for him at the finish.
Roland nodded. I have a job for him. One he and Eddie will do together. Pair that's a fine privy down below Rosalita's cottage. Tall. Strong. Callahan raised his eyebrows.
Aye, say thank you. 'Twas Tian and his neighbor Hugh Anselm who built it.
Could you put a lock on the outside of it in the next few days?
I could, but...
If things go well, no lock will be necessary, but one can never be sure.
No, Callahan said. I suppose one can't. But I can do as you ask.
What's your plan, sugar? Susanna asked. She spoke in a quiet, oddly gentle voice.
There's precious little plan in it. Most times, that's all to the good. The most important thing I can tell you is not to believe anything I say once we get up from here, dust off our bottoms, and rejoin the Falcon. Especially nothing I say when I stand up at the meeting with the feather in my hand. Most of it'll be lies. He gave them a smile. Above it, his faded blue eyes were as hard as rocks. My da and Cuthbert's da used to have a rule between them. First the smiles, then the lies. Last comes gunfire.
We're almost there, aren't we? Susanna asked. Almost to the shooting.
Roland nodded. And the shooting will happen so fast and be over so quick that you'll wonder what all the planning and palaver was for, when in the end it always comes down to the same 5 minutes worth of blood, pain, and stupidity. He paused, then said, I always feel sick afterward, like I did when Bert and I went to see the hanged man.
I have a question,
Jake said. Ask it, Roland told him.
Will we win?
Roland was quiet for such a long time that Susanna began to be afraid. Then he said, We know more than they think we know. Far more. They've grown complacent. If Andy and Slightman are the only rats in the woodpile, and if there aren't too many in the wolf pack, if we don't run out of plates and cartridges, then yes, Jake, son of Elmer, we'll win.
How many is too many?
Roland considered, his faded blue eyes looking east. More than you'd believe, he said at last, and I hope many more than they would. 5. Late that afternoon, Donald Callahan stood in front of the unfound door, trying to concentrate on Second Avenue in the year 1977. What he fixed upon was Choo Choo Mama's and how sometimes he and George and Lupe Delgado would go there for lunch.
I ate the beef brisket whenever I could get it. Callahan said,
and tried to ignore the shrieking voice of his mother rising from the cave's dark belly. When he'd first come in with Roland, his eyes had been drawn to the books Calvin Tower had sent through. So many books! Callahan's mostly generous heart grew greedy and a bit smaller at the sight of them. His interest didn't last, however, just long enough to pull one at random and see it was The Virginian by Owen Wister. It was hard to browse when your dead friends and loved ones were shrieking at you and calling you names. His mother was currently asking him why he had allowed a vampire, a filthy bloodsucker, to break the cross she had given him.
"You was always weak in faith," she said dolorously. "Weak in the faith and strong for the drink. I bet you'd like one right now, wouldn't you?"
Dear God, would he ever. Whiskey, ancient age. Callahan felt sweat break on his forehead. His heart was beating double time, no, triple time.
"The brisket," he muttered, "with some of that brown mustard splashed on top of it."
He could even see the plastic squeeze bottle the mustard came in, and remember the brand name, Plachman's.
"What?" Roland asked from behind him.
"I said I'm ready," Callahan said. "If you're going to do it, for God's love, do it now."
Roland cracked open the box. The chimes at once bolted through Callahan's ears, making him remember the low men in their loud cars. His stomach shriveled inside his belly, and outraged tears burst from his eyes. But the door clicked open, and a wedge of bright sunshine slanted through, dispelling the gloom of the cave's mouth. Callahan took a deep breath and thought, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee," and stepped into the summer of 77. 6. It was noon, of course, lunchtime, and of course he was standing in front of Choo Choo Mama's. No one seemed to notice his arrival. The chalked specials on the easel just outside the restaurant door read, "Hey you, welcome to Choo Choo, specials for June 24th, beef stroganoff, beef brisket with cabbage, Rancho Grande tacos, chicken soup. Try our Dutch apple pie." All right, one question was answered. It was the day after Eddie had come here. As for the next one, Callahan put 46th Street at his back for the time being and walked up 2nd Avenue. Once he looked behind him and saw the doorway to the cave following him as faithfully as the Billy Bumbler followed the boy. He could see Roland sitting there, putting something in his ears to block the maddening tinkle of the chimes. He got exactly 2 blocks before stopping, his eyes growing wide with shock, his mouth dropping open. They had said to expect this, both Roland and Eddie, but in his heart, Callahan hadn't believed it. He'd thought he would find the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind perfectly intact on this perfect summer's day, which was so different from the overcast Kala autumn he'd left. Oh, there might be a sign in the window, reading "Gone on Vacation, Closed Until August," something like that. But it would be there, oh yes. It wasn't, though. At least not much of it. The storefront was a burnt-out husk, surrounded by yellow tape reading "Police Investigation." When he stepped a little closer, he could smell charred lumber, burnt paper, and, very faint, the odor of gasoline. An elderly shoeshine boy had set up shop in front of station shoes and boots nearby. Now he said to Callahan, "Shame, ain't it? Thank God the place was empty."
"Aye, say thank you. When did it happen?"
"Middle of the night, when else? You think them goombars is going to come throw their molly cocktails in broad daylight? They ain't geniuses, but they're smarter than that. Couldn't it have been faulty wiring, or maybe spontaneous combustion?" The elderly shine boy gave Callahan a cynical look. "Aw, please," it said. He cocked a polish-smeared thumb at the smoldering ruin.
"You see that yellow tape? You think they put yellow tape, says Police Investigation, around a place that spontaneously combustulated? No way, my friend. No way, Jose. Cal Tower was in hock to the bad boys up to his eyebrows. Everybody on the block knew it."
The shine boy waggled his own eyebrows, which were lush and white and tangled.
"I hate to think about his loss. He had some very valuable books in the back there, very valuable."
Callahan thanked the shine boy for his insights, then turned and started back down 2nd Avenue. He kept touching himself furtively, trying to convince himself that this was really happening. He kept taking deep breaths of the city air with its tang of hydrocarbons and relished every city sound, from the snore of the buses — there were ads for Charlie's Angels on some of them — to the pounding of the jackhammers and the incessant honking of horns. As he approached Tower of Power Records, he paused for a moment, transfixed by the music pouring from the speakers over the doors. It was an oldie he hadn't heard in years, one that had been popular way back in his Lowell days. Something about following the Pied Piper.
"Crispin St. Peter's," he murmured. "That was his name. Good God, same man, Jesus, I'm really here. I'm really in New York."
As if to confirm this, a harried-sounding woman said, "Maybe some people can stand around all day, but some of us are walking here. Think yous could move it along, or at least get over to the side?" Callahan spoke an apology, which he doubted was heard, or appreciated if it was, and moved along. That sense of being in a dream, an extraordinarily vivid dream, persisted until he neared 46th Street. Then he began to hear the rose, and everything in his life changed. 7. At first, it was little more than a murmur. But as he drew closer, he thought he could hear many voices, angelic voices, singing, raising their confident, joyful psalms to God. He had never heard anything so sweet. And he began to run. He came to the fence and laid his hands against it. He began to weep, couldn't help it. He supposed people were looking at him, but he didn't care. He suddenly understood a great deal about Roland and his friends, and for the first time felt a part of them. No wonder they were trying so hard to survive and to go on. No wonder, when this was at stake. There was something on the other side of this fence with its tattered overlay of posters, something so utterly and completely wonderful. A young man, with his long hair held back in a rubber band and wearing a tipped-back cowboy hat, stopped and clapped him briefly on the shoulder.
"It's nice here, isn't it?" the hippie cowboy said. "I don't know just why, but it really is. I come once a day. You want to know something?"
Callahan turned toward the young man, wiping at his streaming eyes.
"Yes, I guess so."
The young man brushed a hand across his brow, then his cheek.
"I used to have the world's worst acne. I mean, pizza face wasn't even in it. I was roadkill face. Then I started coming here in late March or early April, and everything cleared up." The young man laughed. "The dermo guy my dad sent me to says it's the zinc oxide, but I think it's this place. Something about this place. Do you hear it?"
Although Callahan's voice was ringing with sweetly singing voices, it was like being in Notre Dame Cathedral and surrounded by choirs. He shook his head. Doing so was nothing more than instinct.
"Nah," said the hippie in the cowboy hat. "Me neither. But sometimes I think I do."
He raised his right hand to Callahan, the first two fingers extended in a V.
"Peace, brother?"
"Peace,"
Callahan said, and returned the sign. When the hippie cowboy was gone, Callahan ran his hand across the splintery boards of the fence and a tattered poster advertising War of the Zombies. What he wanted more than anything was to climb over and see the rose, possibly to fall on his knees and adore it. But the sidewalks were packed with people, and already he had attracted too many curious looks, some no doubt from people who, like the hippie cowboy, knew a bit about the power of this place. He would best serve the great and singing force behind this fence. Was it a rose? Could it be no more than that? By protecting it. And that meant protecting Calvin Tower from whoever had burned down his store. Still trailing his hand along the rough boards, he turned onto 46th Street. Down at the end on this side was the glassy green bulk of the UN Plaza Hotel. "Kala Callahan," he thought, and then "Kala Callahan Calvin." And then "Kala come four, there's a rose behind the door. Kala come Callahan, Calvin's one more." He reached the end of the fence. At first he saw nothing, and his heart sank. Then he looked down, and there it was,
at knee height, 5 numbers written in black. Callahan reached into his pocket for the stub of pencil he always kept there, then pulled off a corner of a poster for an off-Broadway play called Dungeon Plunger, a review. On this, he scribbled 5 numbers. He didn't want to leave, but knew he had to. Clear thinking this close to the rose was impossible.
"I'll be back," he told it, and to his delighted amazement, a thought came back, clear and true.
"Yes, Father, any time. Come, Kamala." On the corner of 2nd and 46th, he looked behind him. The door to the cave was still there, the bottom floating about 3 inches off the sidewalk. A middle-aged couple, tourists judging by the guidebooks in their hands, came walking up from the direction of the hotel. Chatting to each other, they reached the door and swerved around it. "They don't see it, but they feel it," Callahan thought. And if the sidewalk had been crowded and swerving had been impossible, he thought in that case they would have walked right through the place where it hung and shimmered, perhaps feeling nothing but a momentary coldness and sense of vertigo. Perhaps hearing faintly the sour tang of chimes and catching a whiff of something like burnt onions or seared meat. And that night, perhaps, they'd have transient dreams of places far stranger than Fun City. He could step back through, probably should. He'd gotten what he'd come for, but a brisk walk would take him to the New York Public Library. There, behind the stone lions, even a man with no money in his pocket could get a little information. The location of a certain zip code, for instance. And, tell the truth and shame the devil, he didn't want to leave just yet. He waved his hands in front of him until the gunslinger noticed what he was doing. Ignoring the looks of the passers-by, Callahan raised his fingers in the air once, twice, 3 times, not sure the gunslinger would get it. Roland seemed to. He gave an exaggerated nod, then thumbs up for good measure. Callahan set off, walking so fast he was nearly jogging. It wouldn't do to linger, no matter how pleasant a change New York made. It couldn't be pleasant where Roland was waiting. And according to Eddie, it might be dangerous as well. 8. The gunslinger had no problem understanding Callahan's message. 30 fingers, 30 minutes. The pair wanted another half an hour on the other side. Roland surmised he had thought of a way to turn the number written on the fence into an actual place. If he could do that, it would be all to the good. Information was power. And sometimes, when time was tight, it was speed. The bullets in his ears blocked the voices completely. The chimes got in, but even they were dulled. A good thing, because the sound of them was far worse than the warble of the finny. A couple of days listening to that sound, and he reckoned he'd be ready for the lunatic asylum. But for 30 minutes, he'd be all right. If worse came to worst, he might be able to pitch something through the door, attract the pair's attention, and get him to come back early. For a little while, Roland watched the street unroll before Callahan. The doors on the beach had been like looking through the eyes of his 3, Eddie, Odetta, Jack Mort. This one was a little different. He could always see Callahan's back in it, or his face if he turned around to look, as he often did. To pass the time, Roland got up to look at a few of the books which had meant so much to Calvin Tower that he'd made their safety a condition for his cooperation. The first one Roland pulled out had the silhouette of a man's head on it. The man was smoking a pipe and wearing a sort of gamekeeper's hat. Court had had one like it, and as a boy, Roland had thought it much more stylish than his father's old day rider with its sweat stains and frayed tug string. The words on the book were of the New York world. Roland was sure he could have read them easily if he'd been on that side, but he wasn't. As it was, he could read some, and the result was almost as maddening as the chimes. "Sherlock Holmes," he read aloud. "No, Holmes, like Odetta's father name. 4 short movels." Movels? No, this one was an N. 4 short novels by Sherlock Holmes. He opened the book, running a respectful hand over the title page and then smelling it. The spicy, faintly sweet aroma of good old paper.
he could make out the name of one of the four short novels, The Sign of the Four. Other than the words hound and study, the titles of the others were gibberish to him.
A sign is a sigil, he said. When he found himself counting the number of